Call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:33 p.m. Wednesday, February 13th, 2019. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Geisel, Senator Stevens, Senator Begich, myself, Senator Wilson. Senator Coghill's excused. Today we will have a presentation from the Department of Health and Social Services on the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. We welcome today Commissioner Crum and Commissioner Wall here to present. Also available on the phone for available for questions and to have a lifeline for the commissioners is Jeremy Barr, the Senior Vice President of WellPath Recovery Solutions, and Dr. Kevin Ann Huxhorn, the Director of the Evidence-Based Practices for WellPath Recovery Solutions. Before we begin this presentation, it is a fairly lengthy presentation, which will take some time to get through. So we're going to ask committee members to sort of hold their questions to the end so they, we can get through the quantity of material. And as the, I know there are a lot of committee members are all eager to ask questions about the budget, since we have a commissioner, I just want to remind the committee that we will have a detailed committee departmental overview, I believe, scheduled for February 27th in front of this committee. So please try to keep your budgetary questions limited to just API if you have any at all. With that, we will, Commissioner, you guys are, floor is yours.
Right on. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
And just as a reminder, just want to remind you guys, since we do have a couple of male voices, when you guys go back and forth, if you could just re-put yourselves back on the record.
Yes, sir. Commissioner Adam Crum, thank you for allowing us here today to brief you on the ongoing crisis at API. It should be of note that when I sat in front of you just a few short weeks ago, I shared my history of volunteering and working with those in need, such as homeless youth, victims of sex trafficking, and those suffering from substance abuse. Joining the Department of Health and Social Services was an opportunity to further work with the most vulnerable among us to fight for them, provide for them, and protect them. One such group that I am responsible for are the patients at Alaska Psychiatric Institute. I was aware coming into this role that API had some issues, but having worked as a consultant for many organizations, I can honestly say I have never seen an organization in such disarray as API. The current situation is the result of ongoing neglect and turmoil that has accumulated over the years, culminating into this most recent crisis. I fully acknowledge that commissioners and legislators prior to myself have worked diligently to address API's issues and notice that its importance to the Alaska's behavioral health continuum of care. But the methods and means of the past have not worked. In this presentation, we will lay out the history of API, but first let me set the stage. Take a journey with me all the way back to 2010. According to our records, this is the last year API went more than 6 months without a major citation or violation. We as a state have failed. We have failed the patients and those seeking treatment by having diminished capacity and quality of care. We have failed the employees by having constant management turnover, given with lack of support and allowing a negative work environment to persist where employees are fearful of being injured or losing their professional license. During my one-on-one meetings with legislators, I received a lot of good input and thoughtful advice. Something Senator Begich said has stuck with me. He told me that as commissioner, I am responsible to be the voice and the advocate for those that don't have a voice, to stand up for those in need. By addressing head-on this very serious issue at API, I am working to give voice to those in need. I cannot stand by and watch patients and staff struggle when I have the ability to do something. We have put forward a plan with very defined deliverables that will bring stability, training, guidance, and support to API. Thank you for the opportunity to share the plan with you in the presentation. We'll start off with Deputy Commissioner Albert Wall.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Deputy Commissioner Albert Wall, for the record. I too want to thank you for your time and having us come over. This has been an issue that I have long been involved with and concerned about. This afternoon, I want to walk you through the issues that we have found at API and exactly how we came about to the decision to contract and the gravity of the situation in the hospital. Is that a little better? In this presentation, we will discuss broadly four issues. These have to do with staff and patient safety, the current inability of API to fulfill its mission, the threat of pending legal issues with a high likelihood of great financial cost to the state, and the even higher cost of our failure in the ethical treatment of Alaskans. I'm going to start with just a brief history of API to underscore a couple of issues and underscore the fact that we knew there were many problems coming in. We knew there was a bed shortage. We knew there were patients backing up in the hospitals, but we did not know the full extent of what had happened. But this isn't a new problem. This slide represents the history in a nutshell of what occurred with inpatient psychiatric care in the state. In 1962, we had 225 beds. And as that facility aged and we went to replace it as a state, there was a study done that said in order to facilitate inpatient psychiatric care in the state properly, we needed 162 beds. The old building was not fully utilized. We could get by with less beds, and so that's what the study indicated. There was a meeting that was held between advocacy groups in the state, and the question of funding those beds came up, and a compromise was reached called the Alyeska Accord in 1992, in which all parties agreed we could get by with 114 beds. In 1993, the department submitted a certificate of need for those 114 beds, and the final product of that was that only 72 beds were funded. I bring this up for a very specific reason, because from the start, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute wasn't enough. It hasn't been enough then, and it's not enough now. It is a highly volatile focal point. It's always in the news. And yes, it is the epicenter of inpatient psychiatric care for the state, but it is not the entire system of care, and the entire system of care is in jeopardy as well. In 2005, the facility expanded from 72 to 80 beds, and we were still well below the number at that point from 1992 study, and the population in the state had increased. Since 2005, there have been a series of increasingly pointed studies and reports and assessments of the facility, and they've been produced at a staggering rate. More than one a year has come out since 2005. The Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, known as WICHE, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the Public Consulting Group, consultants Agnew Beck, consultant Dr. Dvorskin, the attorney Bill Evans, OSHA, consultant Dr. Fox, the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, the McDowell Group, and more have all been through that building and done repeated studies with the same findings and growing alarm in each year. They have all studied the situation over time. They have repeatedly warned of the crisis. They have repeatedly offered solutions, and none have worked. There has been some progress made at API to rectify certain situations, but it has been too little, too slow, and too late. In 2000, the situation got worse. In 2017, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services warned that they would remove API's certification if it was not substantively in line with the plan of correction when they came back. There have been repeated assaults, repeated injury, and at this present time, we can only muster enough staff for 35 beds. 35 patients out of the 80 beds in the building. The culmination of this was that on January 29th of this year, at what was supposed to be the last survey team from CMS on site to approve our compliance with the recently accepted plan of correction, an unreported assault that caused a finding of immediate jeopardy was discovered, and the commissioner said, enough is enough. We need help. We need expert help. And we need it immediately. I want to talk for just a minute about the forces external to the Institute that have an impact on the operations and care. All eyes are on API, as I mentioned before, always. The media has a lot to say about the place, some bad, some uninformed, some on point. Everyone has an opinion. Sit next to someone on a plane and they have an opinion. Those are all opinion statements, but there are forces that actually have authority over what we do in the building, and they're on the screen for you today. The level of scrutiny is intense, sometimes demoralizing to staff, but it's important because these organizations are there to tell us when we're off track and keep us on point on issues of safety and patient care. I want to walk you through a couple of these. Many of them have slides. I'm not going to read every slide. I think you can do that. I'm going to talk about what they mean for API. The one group that doesn't have a slide is the professional licensing up in the left-hand corner. Professional licensing applies to any agency with professionally licensed healthcare providers in it, and they, under their licensure, they're mandated to behave in a certain way. Registered nurses have a certain capacity of clinical care. Medical doctors have a certain other capacity of clinical care. Nurse assistants have another role. And so each has a role to play, and professional licensing has a part of that. We'll start out with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. This organization is primarily concerned with staff safety and the safety in the workplace. It's a federal agency that sets and enforces protective workplace safety and health standards. And they may levy fines on agencies that are not in compliance. You may recall that we have had OSHA findings at the building, and we currently have plans of correction for that, and I'll get to that just a little bit later. The Alaska Ombudsman's Office is also in a position where they have a regulatory obligation, statutory obligation, to intervene in certain situations. Among the many services that they provide, they investigate complaints that involve state agencies and determine appropriate remedies. The ombudsman initiated an investigation in July of last year, and I need to correct this slide, please, if I may. It wasn't the final report. That's a preliminary report of findings was given to us just yesterday. I want to respect the ombudsman's process, and I would ask you to work with their office on receiving what they can in that report. But I will tell you that there were findings in that report. And we're looking forward to a conversation with them as we move forward. Another body is the Joint Commission. The Joint Commission is a national not-for-profit accrediting agency which currently accredits nearly 21,000 healthcare organizations. Basically, they're a peer-to-peer organization that sets standards for other agencies that are like them. So they'll come on site and make sure that you're operating in compliance with certain standards, and they have a couple of authorities. They can inform the Centers of Medicaid and Medicare Services of your deficiencies. They can also drop your accreditation, which affects your state licensure. They can also act as agents of CMS under certain situations under contract. And so it's important when they come in as an investigation or a survey, they'll give you also a report of findings, and the hospital will need to come back into compliance of that if there's any deficiencies. Another important thing about the Joint Commission is that they publish an annual report of top performers in the field, and basically those top performers are what they use to compare other agencies in the country to. This brings us to an in-state operation, which is health facilities licensing and certification. To operate in Alaska, a hospital, any hospital, must be licensed by the state under the statute. And then the department then sets the standards and requirement for licensure through state regulation. If API does not maintain its licensure, it cannot operate as a hospital in the state. And so finally, we come to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. This is a federal agency that provides oversight for healthcare services that receive federal funding. And so, of course, if they're going to give you federal funding for something, they want to make sure that their standards and regulations are also maintained. They have a very strict survey process, an investigation process that's quite delineated. You'll learn a little bit more about it as we go through this, but generally, you must meet the conditions of participation that are given to you by the federal government in order to receive federal funding. It's interesting how surveys occur. An on-site inspection can occur basically at any time. It can be triggered by a complaint, an event, an overall recertification survey, a scheduled event on an annual or a triannual basis, and they do not have to tell you when they show up in the building. They simply show up. They are the authority. They come in. They ask for your assistance to go through your records, look at your clinical operation, and then they make a report and they leave. It is sometime after that that you get the copy of what that report said, and they begin working with you on any deficiencies that were found. A condition of participation for federal funding is that we must be in substantial compliance with each condition of participation. If you are not in substantial compliance, CMS will decertify the hospital and terminate its participation in Medicaid and Medicare, which would result in the loss of all federal funding for the facility. I want to talk about a little bit about the types of citations that these agencies can find when they come into an organization. There's basically three levels. It's much more complex than what I can get on this slide. There's a whole bunch of different tags. Some are have to do with the physical plants. Some have to do with the clinical oversight. Some have to do with operation. But these are the three basic types of deficiencies. There's the standard, a condition level, and immediate jeopardy. I'll give you just an example of some of the things that were in each of these categories for API on some of the reviews. On a standard level deficiency example, usually has to do with proper credentialing and or proper documentation on things. One of the findings was they observed during the document review that staff who were responsible for signing biohazard manifest documents at the time they arrived did not have evidence of EPA training for that substance. So that's like an example of a condition level deficiency. I mean, a standard level deficiency. A condition level deficiency is something much more serious than that. And that an example of that is when they went through and they found our beds on the forensics ward, on the criminal restoration ward, in the TACU ward, did not meet the new ligature standards, meaning there were items on the beds that a patient could potentially harm themselves with. And they had to be brought into compliance with. That meant purchasing new beds for that. So those are some examples. I would also take a moment just to tell you, and I know you received the email, but we did post a website that has the reports on it, and you can go through and see all of the findings. I will tell you in advance that many times they cut and paste the same finding under different tags. So you might see the same thing like eight times. And the reason why they do that is because it hits multiple areas of the report. They just cut and paste the same verbiage back into a new area. That's really the same finding. On the far right of this slide is an immediate jeopardy finding. This is the worst type. It's a showstopper. It is a situation in which the provider's noncompliance with one or more requirements of participation has caused or is likely to cause serious injury, harm, impairment, or death to a resident. Again, CMS and the Joint Commission focus more on the patient safety side of the house, and OSHA focuses on the staff's safety side of the house. The reason why I'm showing you each of these is because as we move forward, you will see where we have received these, and indeed we did receive an immediate jeopardy finding on January 29th. What happens after the report occurs is CMS will go back. They'll put their statement of deficiencies together. They provide it to the hospital. The hospital then, the clock starts ticking. The hospital has 10 calendar days to provide an acceptable plan of correction for each cited deficiency. That process can take a long time. And the reason why is because you can put together a draft of how you're going to correct a plan or a problem, send it to them, and they don't like it. So then you're in this negotiation stage going back and forth. In fact, when the commissioner was appointed to this position, we were under a plan of correction that had not yet been accepted. And in fact, the timeline on that is pretty critical, and I may be just a little bit out of sync with where the slides are, but means I'm here, I'll tell you now. The CMS survey that we were working off went through in July, and there were substantial findings on that survey, and the department began to put together a plan of correction that was not fully accepted by CMS, and they spent out their first 90-day period doing that. You have 90 days to write your plan of correction, have it accepted, and show yourself in substantial compliance with that plan before the survey team comes back. When the survey team came back at the end of that 90 days, they found we still didn't have a plan, and we were still out of compliance. And you will recall that senior leadership at that time resigned, and we entered the second 90-day phase. After the second 90-day phase, there are no more exemptions. There are no extensions. That was due on November 26th. At that point in time, the survey team was going to show up and find out what we had done to improve the situation, and there was still no accepted plan of correction. On November 30th, the survey team showed up for their final inspection, and you will recall what happened. The survey team was actually in the building when the earthquake hit. Because of that, They all went home, and they graciously gave us another 90 days because we were under a state of emergency to produce the plan of correction. That's when the commissioner came in and found we still didn't have a plan of correction. We were under a very dire situation, and we didn't have continuity in the leadership to know what was happening in the plan of correction in the first place. We're going to talk a little bit about the plans of correction, just to show you some history. API has been under two plans of correction in the last 12 months, two OSHA citations pending resolution. API has had 13 site visits from regulatory agencies in the last 12 months. The most recent two surveys identified three condition level deficiencies and an incident of immediate jeopardy. Again, I'll go back to that and just tell you that's a showstopper. That's when somebody's life, limb, or eyesight, they're in immediate danger of harm. That incident is still under investigation. I'm not going to go too much in depth. I will say that there was unwanted contact between two patients, and we still do not have the final report back from CMS at this time. We're still waiting on that statement of deficiencies. I'll back up just a little bit and say that we were successful in certain regards. We had made some movement. The plan of correction that we had been working on after we came into office really took us through the end of December to complete and get it accepted by CMS, but we finally did. After over 180 days of working with the federal government, we finally got a plan of correction accepted early in January. You may recall I actually was quoted saying I thought we were making progress, and at that point we were. We had produced a plan of correction that was acceptable to the federal government, and I thought we were headed in the right direction. And then the survey team came back and found this. I want to segue from that conversation about oversight and investigations and regulatory bodies and take you to where really the rubber hits the road. What does it look like in the hospital? So you have an investigative body that comes in. What do they look at and what do they find? What are the problems? The issue that we have the biggest problem with over time is the issue of seclusion and restraint. All patients have the right to be free from physical or mental abuse and corporal punishment. But you'll see the last line there under 42 CFR. It says, restraint or seclusion may only be imposed to ensure the immediate physical safety of the patient, a staff member, or others, and must be discontinued at the earliest possible time. This is the area in which we've had the most findings. And it's a difficult balance in an inpatient psychiatric unit because the patients that you work with are inherently at times dangerous. And the symptomology of their disease is sometimes erratic and dangerous to themselves and others. And so if they're in a high state of agitation and you can't get them to be safe, sometimes you have to restrain and seclude an individual. However, it's very clear that it must be only for the safety of the patient or staff member. It must be discontinued at the earliest possible time. When you get into the reports that we published on the website, you'll see about nine of these that are listed in the examples in there of what exactly happened is just written right there for you to see. Since 2011, there have been seven separate independent reports indicating API uses seclusion and restraint inappropriately and or excessively. Since 2017, just in the last 2 years, API has been cited at least seven separate times for deficiencies including violations of patient rights and use of seclusion and restraint. You see what the ombudsman complaint in their initiated investigation was for back in June, and I mentioned the preliminary report that just came out. But those are all about risk to harm patients using force, risk to harm patients doing violence, not in compliance with the use of seclusion and restraint. This brings us to the other side of the conversation. So you have the issue of patient safety, but you also have the issue of staff safety. There have been multiple citations by OSHA in API. And you see two listed there, 2014, 2017. And again, you see the history of what happened. One of the failures was that API failed to maintain its OSHA log, which is it's a log of violations or a log of incidents, from 2011 to 13, including not accurately reporting injuries related to incidents. And then you go down to the next one, it's the same exact thing from 2014 to 2017. So basically from 2011 to 2017, they were failing to track and report injuries appropriately. And then there's this litany of reports. 2015, API is seriously and dangerously understaffed. 2018, API is an unsafe work environment for staff. September of 18, injury rates at API doubled. And then it culminates in this incident of immediate jeopardy. I went through the stack of reports starting back in 2005 and combed through them, looking at the things that they found. And I found this really poignant statement to me. The Witcher Report wrote, "This set of challenges," I'm just reading the underlined portion, "this set of challenges has reached crisis proportions, and it is not realistic to approach these issues with modest adjustments to existing processes." That was written in 2011. For the next 8 years, we have attempted to fix these issues with modest adjustments to existing processes, and it has failed to work. The next area I want to talk about is an area that most of the reports have indicated is a serious issue, and that is the staffing challenge at API. And here, I've got to say, we've all tried to fix this problem. The legislature tried to fix this problem. I greatly appreciate the fact that over the last 2 years, you have put new PCNs into API where you've taken PCNs away from other places. It's been phenomenal to watch 102 new PCNs go into API's budget over the last 2 years. The issues are very complex when it comes to this, and I understand that we can open up a PCN and attempt to recruit for it, and we have been. If you go on the website, there's recruitment out for, I think, 87 different positions this morning, and I have a list of those. But there are very unique challenges to these positions, and we can talk about some of those. One of the problems is the way in which our staff are classified. And again, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody or saying a person individually did something wrong. It's just the system has risen over time to be a real problem. There's no differentiation currently, and there is a study underway, but there's no differentiation currently between any type of nurse and the nurses that are at the psychiatric institute. And so when you're faced as a professional, as a licensed professional, when you're faced with the choice between working at a place for 30% less pay, where you're subject to violence and getting yelled at and cursed at, where you may be spit upon, and there's great trouble among the rest of the staff, or you can go across the street to two other hospitals and get paid more and have their compensation packet. You really have to be called ideologically to work at API, and you do it as a loss. There hasn't been a significant review of the nurse job classes, and I'm focusing on this one because really that's where the greatest need is. There's been salary increases at portions, but not a whole classification study. There is one going on right now, but again, it's an effort that is too little and too late, and we've arrived at a place of crisis. I'll point out that there have been other encouraging things that have happened. You know, we have received bonuses for nurses when they sign on. Healthcare practitioners can volunteer and get extra pay for certain things like working a weekend shift. Healthcare practitioner ones, which are your mid-level practitioners, they are eligible for a $15,000 sign-on bonus, and you see the dates there. But again, when you go through the actual effect, most of these bonuses came into effect quite recently. The pay bonuses all came into effect just last September and October, and they have not to date had a tremendous impact. We have, since that period of time, hired 6 new nurses, but we've also lost 6 new nurses, or 6 nurses, to attrition. So it's been a net gain.
And Commissioner Wolf, GGU, I just want to, acronyms throughout the...
I'm sorry, that's the supervisory union versus the non-supervisory union.
Thank you.
I apologize, I tried to get all the acronyms out. I'll give you another example. Not all of it has to do with the classification across the whole classification. Some of them are just individual positions. One of the occupational therapist positions that we've had in active recruitment for over a year with no applicants at all is this occupational therapist position here. It requires a national board certification as an occupational therapist and a state license. It's only a range 17. And it simply is not enough to attract anybody in the professional category to apply for. I have a list of vacancies and recruitment times. These are just the clinical ones. Again, 30 nurses, 5 psychiatrist vacancies, a medical officer, psychologists, forensic evaluators, and I'll tell you, many of these, with the exception of the nurses. Many of these we've had no applicants for. One of the things that happens when you see the trouble in an organization that's ongoing, and the press is there, and there's problems inside between staff, is new applicants that are looking at it from the outside just don't want to go work there. They don't even bother to apply, and that's a difficult place in which we find us. If you are a medical doctor and a professional, and you have a license, and you're looking at where you should go work, and you know that an organization is in trouble, and they've had repeated findings of safety, and repeated findings of violence, and repeated findings of seclusion and restraint issues, you really have to think hard as to whether or not you're going to go work there, and that's what we're up against.
To that, I'll add, it also does not help the employee morale and the overall, Commissioner Crum, the overall morale when in the newspapers it is cited and called the worst hospital in the United States. That is an ongoing issue with the recruitment efforts as well.
And so, again, I'm Al Wall, Deputy Commissioner. So I've talked a little bit about some of the challenges we face in the regulatory oversight and the conditions that we're under currently. I want to switch gears just a little bit and talk about yet another problem, which to me is an even deeper issue, and that is a human question. It's an ethical question. There are two types of individuals that find their way to Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Sometimes they go there on a civil commitment, which we'll talk about in a minute. Those are individuals who have not been charged with a crime, but they're in the throes of a serious mental illness and they need treatment, and somebody's having them committed to the hospital. And then there are criminal charges that bring a person to API. What happens with a forensic patient, you see the statute quote there, is we are statutorily obligated to provide care, evaluation and care, for individuals that have been charged with a crime but are likely to be incompetent for that crime. Two things must happen. They must be evaluated, and there's a very specific process for that. There's a statutory designation. It actually requires 2 forensic psychologists, which I can get into in a second if you'd like. But it's very complicated, and indeed, we're not in compliance with that statute in the state. We don't have 2 forensic psychologists in the state, and so we're out of compliance with that. But the first thing they have to do is be evaluated. And the second thing is, if they are found to be incompetent, they're sent to API for periods of time that are statutorily controlled for restoration. What happens in our current situation is we simply don't have the staff and the beds necessary to treat the individuals that fall into this category. And unfortunately, a very unconscionable thing occurs. And this is why I call it a human issue and an ethical question, because these individuals end up in jail. They end up in jail without diagnosis. They end up in jail with charges, but no conviction. And they sit there for long periods of time waiting for somebody to come help them. They have no voice. They have no treatment. And they're sitting in jail. And for me, that is absolutely unconscionable. This morning, I checked the numbers. I'm not sure if I have the numbers exactly right for today, but yesterday we had 54 individuals, thank you, waiting for their initial evaluation. We had 28 that have been evaluated and found in need treatment that can't get into the hospital because we don't have any place to put them. Now, I'm going to go a place with this because there's a very in-depth legal and financial question that we have with this problem. But I want to sit on the ethical thing for just a second and ask you. If you walk into a situation that we did, and you're appointed to take care of a group of people, and you find 50, 60, 70, 80 plus sitting in jail without treatment and without some of them without conviction and no place to go, what is your choice and what do you do? We have a very limited bandwidth to take care of people. It is our moral obligation to do so. What happens on the legal side, now that I've talked a little bit about the ethical side, but on the legal side is, well, you end up in court. We currently have an ongoing court case. I can't talk much about that, obviously, because it is a court case. But I will tell you that there are immense ramifications to that court case, and I'll talk to you about them a little bit towards the end of this presentation. I'm going to leave that information up there for just a minute. But we have court cases, both complaints on the civil side and on the criminal side as well. I talked a little bit about the criminal side. The civil commitment side is also complex, not quite as much so as others, but we really have a system that's on the civil commitment side, born on the backs of a single evaluation by a clinician, usually in an emergency room. And there's only one of two outcomes to that evaluation. And the outcome is either, one, you are a danger to yourself or others, is grave and gravely disabled, and you need to go someplace special to get treated, or you are not, and you don't. Those are your choices. And so the hospitals then are left in a terrible bind where they have an individual in the emergency room whom obviously they can't let go because they need help, but they're in a situation where they simply can't treat them. And right today we have 14 people in that situation across the state. So in addition to what you found on the forensic side, which was over 80, you also have 14 on the civil side, which are waiting, three of whom are juveniles. And here's the worst part for me, two of them are in the Department of Corrections because we have no other place to put them. So now we have people there who don't even have criminal charges. I'm going to move into the consequences of this, and I'm not going to go slide by slide. I think you will have time at a different time to do that. I'm going to hit just some highlights, because what happens in a state when they find themselves in our current situation is a legal issue. We are obligated by both federal and state laws to take care of inpatient psychiatric patients in a certain way. We are failing to do so, and when you fail to obey your own laws, there are consequences. In the state of Washington, there was what was called the True Blood case, and I encourage you to look into that. But the ramifications of exactly our situation were immense. So the 2015 trial resulted in a ruling that the department had violated their class members' constitutional rights. And the court ordered the state to move these criminal the individuals with criminal charges out of jail into treatment facilities within 7 to 14 days and pay for it. In addition to the treatment that was going on, the contempt order of July 7th in 2016 fined the department $500 per day for exceeding a deadline, a 7-day deadline, and $1,000 per day for exceeding a 14-day deadline. Their daily fine was over $100,000 general fund a day at one point. As of June 2018, fines for failure to comply with the court orders exceeded $55 million. That's just the fines. We haven't even got to the treatment yet. The settlement agreement approved by the court in just last month, December, I guess 2 months ago now, requires the state to make changes in five substantive areas: competency evaluations, restoration services, triage and diversion, education and training, workforce development, and, by the way, pay for it. So the state then becomes ordered by the court to designate the funding to pay for these services under these circumstances. They also had their hospital decertified in July, like I was talking about earlier, the potential for ours. And they lost $53 million in federal funding per year for that facility. They had recently spent, you see the highlighted area there, they had recently spent $360 million in state hospitals and $560 million in mental health spending and had not brought themselves back into compliance. These are huge numbers in their general fund. I'm not going to go in depth, just in the interest of time. I know you all must have lots of questions, but the case study for Pennsylvania is there. The case study for Utah is there. The case study for Louisiana is there. These are huge issues. They are real. And so you have two sides of this problem. You have the staff safety and the patient safety and the ongoing issues of safety and clinical compliance. And you have to be proactive about fixing the problem before the court orders you to do so. And in the middle, you have the ethical dilemma about how you're going to care for people who cannot care for themselves and have no voice. That's what we're faced with. Now I want to move out of the dilemma into the decision to hire WellPath. We actually started talking to contractors fairly early in the process because, like I said, when we got into office, there was no plan of correction. We were out of compliance and being threatened with decertification, and so we sought help. What we were looking for was a contractor that could ensure the safety of our staff and patients, bring the hospital into rapid compliance with regulatory authority, and prepare the facility to increase its bed capacity to 80 beds by July 1st. That is ambitious, but absolutely critical. And so the things we did, think of our first day we walked in was the 10th, December 10th, something like the 3rd. One of the first conversations I remember having with the commissioner was about Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And if you remember in his confirmation hearing before this committee, it was number 2 on the top 3 issues that he wanted to fix. And again, even at that point, we didn't know exactly how bad it was. On December 18th, I contacted the National Association of State Mental Health Programs Directors. It's really the association for all states when they run inpatient psychiatric facilities, and it's a standards in peer-to-peer relationship with them. They have specialists, and they can kind of give you some guidance. They don't recommend specifically one course of action, but they'll say, hey, this state is doing this, and this state is doing that, and I had some conversation with them. And at that point, honestly, the conversation in my head was, well, how are we going to move through this issue? Should I hire a contractor that just help us get our plan of correction together and get it submitted to CMS? Should I hire a contractor that does some sort of administrative services oversight of the whole thing? Should I hire a contractor and do a privatization of the whole thing, like, immediately right now? What are our options, and how can we intervene? We contacted WellPath Recovery Solutions on December 20th. It was interesting. My first contact with them was actually not even about API. It was about healthcare and other facilities, but it led to a conversation about that. And the second conversation I had was with Liberty Healthcare Corporation on January 8th. Asked them the same kind of questions. Met with Noel Ray of Networks Health from the Virginia Mason Health System. Actually met him at API on the 22nd. I had that conversation. And during this timeline, of course, we are daily learning more concerning facts about API, and it's becoming more and more evident that the depth of the issue there is bigger than we had thought. This led up to, first off, our plan of correction being accepted in early January, and me believing we had a little bit more breathing room now, and that the survey, when they came back, was going to be okay, and they would work with us on this. To them actually coming back on the 29th and finding the immediate jeopardy. I'm going to stress to you how unusual and grave that is. To my knowledge, we've never had another immediate jeopardy finding in a report at API. And to me, it's just the culmination of a long history. And the question then becomes, how much worse do we want to wait to let it get before we intervene? The steps had to be immediate. So on the day that we found it, we, of course, removed the perpetrator to another ward. Unfortunately, I've indicated that we only have 35 beds currently being used, so we had a completely vacant ward. He could have all to himself, so we moved the patient over there. We implemented a new safety protocol, including 24/7 video surveillance and communication to the ward. And then we implemented an hourly reporting system to each ward for them to monitor every patient on an hourly basis, including what they're doing for behavioral health risk mitigation, and push that up. That report actually went clear up the chain to me on an hourly basis, clear through the weekend, until we could get a nationally recognized specialist in psychiatric treatment and safety to come to API immediately for safety oversight. So the amount of time between discovering the incident and getting a specialist on the ground was very quick. It was basically Thursday night, found out about it, specialist on the ground Monday. And the safety protocol was in place in the interim. The final decision on WellPath really then had to be made right after the immediate jeopardy was found. The company was chosen for the following reasons. It was available immediately, and as you can probably imagine, there are not a lot of companies in the country that have a ready and willing pool of psychiatric specialists that just jet out to wherever they need to be and intervene. But WellPath has that. They're available immediately. They had specific inpatient psychiatric experience, including both civil and criminal commitments. And they have a team of nationally recognized experts that has the experience and track record to bring non-compliant hospitals back into compliance rapidly. I'm not sure. Is that it? The website for all the documentation is on the screen. I believe you've had that in the email format, but for everybody in the room. There's also been an email address that's set up specifically for questions, concerns, complaints, whatever you need to get to. It is api.info@alaska.gov. And if you have questions, I encourage you to reach through there. Of course, the commissioner and I are open to anything as well. We just have a very high volume of emails. And that particular email address is staffed and can triage and make sure that your questions or concerns gets to the right place.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Thank you, Commissioner, for presenting here. Before we go into questions, I just want to recognize Rep. Stories in the audience as well. Thank you, Representative, for coming here in today. Open up to committee questions. Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate learning what's going on. I just need to know, in hiring WellPath, does that put off the certification or the accreditation process? Does it give us more time to answer that? And then my other question along with that is, knowing there are always lawsuits, and how does that work? Would WellPath be sued, or would we be sued? Who's responsible in the end?
To the first part of the question, this is Adam Crum again. We have, as we evaluated this process and saw the depth of the crisis that was going on there, we did reach out actively to our accrediting bodies and those individuals, and their biggest concern was that the state of Alaska had failed over the years to actually make what they said substantive change, to actually take steps in the right direction. We had gotten very good at saying we were going to fix the problem and address it, but nothing truly was done to correct it. And the reason why API wasn't shut down years ago was because it is such a critical aspect of the behavioral health system in Alaska. And this was repeated to us by a couple of different governing bodies. And so as we told them, as we're looking at this, as we're taking these situations, we understand what's going on. We're going to take a very proactive and aggressive approach to actually improving our patient safety and our employee safety, as well as our psychiatric outcomes. And so we have worked with them. They have given us no guarantees that this will do this, but this is us truly showing we are taking a substantial step towards improving the situation there, sir.
Follow-up, Senator?
So the first part of the question, that it does give us a little more time to deal with certification and accreditation, and then also the question about who's responsible legally, either the person or the company we're working with or the state of Alaska.
Senator Wilson, through the chair. This is Albert Wall. So the response to the first part of the question is whether or not it gives us more time. The answer to that is actually no. We are still waiting on the report from CMS. We could at any day get a report from them that we have been decertified, and that's just the truth. We could also receive a report that we are being conditionally certified under certain circumstances. We could also receive a report that says, okay, you're certified, but we're going to hold your feet to the fire to the plan of correction. The contract that we did with WellPath takes into account those eventualities. So should we prove that we're decertified, their task then is to recertify us within the time allotted by CMS, which is a 90-day window. If we're not decertified, but we have to do the plan of correction implementation, which we would have to do anyways, their task then is to implement that and bring us back into rapid compliance. And please understand that, yes, the decertification is a huge issue, but we still have the ombudsman's report, the OSHA violations, the Joint Commission, and another finding by CMS. So this is going to be an ongoing iterative process. I don't think they're going to give us any more extensions in time. We're simply going to have to fix the problems. The second part of your question as to who holds legal liability, I guess my answer would have to be it depends on what you're talking about. If it is a direct patient care issue, if it's an administrative issue, it just depends on who you're talking about. I would defer to the Department of Law for specificity on that. If you have specific questions of incidents, I'm sure that they'll be able to give you a read on it.
And just for clarification, you know, we're looking at the vacancies that you went over, the 30 nurses, 5 psychiatrists, medical officer. Are these going to be then state employees going forth, or are these employees of WellPath being contracted? I guess if you guys can talk a little bit more upon the contractual nature of what services are being contracted out. Is it the pharmaceutical? Is it just...
Mr. Chair, I really appreciate that question. I think it's a good chance to kind of describe the structure of the contract. The contract's really in two phases. The first phase is the three deliverables I showed early on, which is bring us into rapid compliance, ensure safety, and prepare to have beds open by July 1st. Those are the three basics. If they can prove those deliverables, then we move into the next phase, which, yes, is a privatization phase. Between now and that period of time, the state employees remain state employees, and we are still hiring. We will have conversations with those employees that we hire, let them know that's going on. If they still want to come work under those circumstances, yes, by all means, we are hiring, and I believe that the situation at API is improving, and we want as many applicants as we can possibly get. In particular, if you're a nurse or a doctor, please come talk to me. But at the time at which we segue into what WellPath actually taking over, they are building a packet, and we'll have a conversation with employees. And you can they're on the line, as a reminder, and you can certainly talk to them about that. But there will be a plan in place. I'm having ongoing conversations. Just as I walked in here, spoke to one of the union heads and asked for a time that we can sit down and talk in an ongoing fashion, not just once, but have conversations moving forward. And I think I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is a what if type of question. If API was contracted to the organization's name is WellPath. Thank you. Would the state ombudsman still have some authority to do investigations and reports?
This is through the chair. This is Adam Crump. I do not know that. We can get back to you, but she is in the room.
And please, I believe the ombudsman is going to come and write. And thank you, Kate, for being so readily available.
Senator Giesel, through the chair, this is Kate Burkhardt. I am the Alaska State Ombudsman. At this point, the way the commissioner and deputy commissioner have described it, the ombudsman still has jurisdiction over actions at the hospital. However, if the hospital moves into private management and the employees are employed by a private company, the way the ombudsman statute is written right now, the ombudsman would not have jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Thank you. And just, is there a way that, I'll defer this to another time. That's fine. Any follow-up, Senator?
No, okay. Thank you.
Senator Begich.
As you might imagine, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might have a few questions here. I want first for both of you to thank you for a pretty rapid presentation of a pretty comprehensive issue, and I don't think anybody here doubts the seriousness of the issue and the emergency nature of the issue. I guess I want to talk about a couple of things. The first thing, I just was looking at your timeline, and I hadn't seen this timeline before, so back in on December 18th, you indicated that you contacted the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, and in doing so, what was the reason you were doing that? Were you already anticipating privatization of this facility?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, this is Adam Crum. The reason we were reaching out at that time is we did not have an active plan of correction that was accepted by CMS. As we were scrambling, we looked at the lack of leadership that we had at API because we had so many vacant positions. We were looking for, is this possible to reach out? So the conversation with them was, are there contractors available that can come in and at least consult, help with the plan of correction? What are the other options? Can it be possibly administrative services side? And that was the intent of that initial conversation as we were gathering, because I believe at that point in time it was about 2 weeks on the job.
Mr. Chairman, just as a follow-up to that, and then I have some other questions, but please. The follow-up to that would be, can you provide for us, for this committee, the correspondence that you had with the National Association so that we can be apprised of how that process went forward? Is that something you could do?
Senator Begich, through the chair, there is in the website that's posted the email conversations that we had with NASHMED. Those are after the date of the original contact, which was by telephone. Mm-hmm. I used to be a member of NASHMED and know their fellows, so I called them and said, here's our situation, what do you suggest? And so the original conversations were by phone with follow-up by email.
I noticed that the contact, Mr. Chairman, then contact the WellPath Recovery Solutions, and I have some questions about WellPath in a moment they may be able to answer perhaps, occurred 2 days later on December 20th. Was that before or after you received before or after you began to correspond by email with the National Association?
Senator Begich, through the chair, I believe that was prior to email correspondence. NASHMED took a while getting back to me by email. And I would reiterate that my first contact with WellPath actually wasn't about this issue. The email, I think, that was sent on the 20th was about healthcare and juvenile justice facilities or something to that nature, but it's in the packet.
Okay. Appreciate that. A couple of other questions. You mentioned, Mr. Chairman, at the beginning of your presentation on page 2, that you were pending legal issues were extreme risk of high cost to the state. Were you aware of the two companies that are the parent companies of WellPath having, at least in one case, over 1,300 lawsuits filed against them in the last decade, and hundreds more with the other? That's Correct Care, and I'm just looking at my names and my notes here, Correctional Medical Group.
Through the chair, Senator Begich, this is Adam Crum. If the representatives from WellPath on the phone would like to address that question.
All right. Mr. Chairman? I was actually asking if they were aware of those lawsuits. They can answer the lawsuit question, but I'm just curious if our state reps those representing the state of Alaska were aware of these lawsuits.
Okay. Commissioner?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Begich, yes, we were aware of those, but as those occurred, a lot of those were in prison or correctional facilities, and the WellPath Recovery Solutions, their entire focus is on psychiatric hospitals and providing behavioral health issues. And so I believe that's where the clarification aspect could come from the representatives from WellPath.
And is there, you know, which one here? We'll try with Mr. Barr. Mr. Barr, are you with us today?
I am. Thank you.
If you can just state your name for the record and your affiliation, and you can, do you need the question to be repeated for you?
Jeremy Barr, WellPath Recovery Solutions for the record. And I just want to make sure, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yep. Thank you, and thank you, Commissioner, and thank you to the committee. Yeah, so WellPath Recovery Solutions partners exclusively with state behavioral health agencies to provide services to patients like those served at API. As it relates to the larger question surrounding litigation, we are a division within a larger organization that provides healthcare services in a variety of public health settings. Some of those are prisons and jail settings, and there is a certain amount of litigation that is associated with that. The vast majority of those, more than 90%, are dismissed out of hand, and those are pro se cases that are found without merit. And then when you are comparing kind of the bulk of that information versus the total daily population across the company, which is approximately 250,000 patients, you're looking at something that looks a lot like a community ER. And when you compare us to a like healthcare system, because we are a healthcare company, you'll find that the incidence of litigation where there are settlements made is less than a fourth of what you would find in a community ER setting.
May I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Begich?
You're indicating the difference between, I think, the two companies that have formed WellPath. How long has WellPath been in existence as WellPath?
Question, are you asking specifically, again, Jeremy Barr, WellPath Recovery Solutions, about WellPath Recovery Solutions and that part of the company, the broader parent company?
Well, you've created, if I can, Mr. Chairman, you've created a separation between the two, so I'm simply asking about how long has WellPath been in existence?
So WellPath was the combination of two companies this past October. One of those companies was in Correct Care Solutions. One of those was called Correctional Medical Group Companies. Those two entities were merged in October of this past year. WellPath Recovery Solutions was an entity associated with Correct Care Solutions and operated at that time as Correct Care Recovery Solutions. As part of the merger of these two companies, a new name was chosen that expressed our kind of vision as a healthcare company, and WellPath Recovery Solutions, the new name chosen for what was once Correct Care Recovery Solutions.
Senator Begich,
I have three other questions, and then I'll be done. And they're not for WellPath at this point, so. The very quick questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Barr. If you could stay online just for any additional questions. Senator Begich.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an $84 million contract. Did you get done under the emergency procurement power, as I understand it? Did you get a legal opinion before you requested that, and is it posted online with the other online information?
Senator Begich, through the chair, the answer to that question is yes, and it's posted online.
Appreciate that. The second question related to this is a temporary. We're talking about a temporary, which is ill-defined in the statute. I understand that. What does temporary mean to you? What is your definition of temporary emergency? Emergency is the emergency procurement. Emergency procurement is for a temporary period because procurement law requires competitive bidding, preparation for that competitive bidding, et cetera. So what is your sense of temporary so that we can know what the sense of temporary here is?
Senator Begich, through the chair. So I'm glad you asked that question because I learned a great deal in this process. I actually used the wrong word in certain places with procurement initially, and then the lawyer straightened me out. So initially I was using emergency and we were talking single source, and so I was talking single source emergency, and it was difficult for me because I was using the wrong words for it. What I would recommend, if I may, is to get clarification from procurement and from the attorneys, because we have a written explanation of it in the packet, but I think it would behoove us to get you a specific answer.
And then my final question.
And if you could provide that to the committee so we can disseminate it to members, be good. Thank you.
I'm looking at the statement made by the commissioner and that you repeated, Deputy Commissioner, which is if they are successful in the first phase through June 30, 2019, WellPath will assume full responsibility of API after July 1, 2019. And the reason I'm bringing that specific specific phrasing up, it sounds like you move then from some temporary procurement responsibility to an actual long-term action that has gone through no competitive process, that has had no process that the procurement code requires, so that we at least have the chance for some of these other entities that you've contacted, or Providence Hospital or other groups, to consider the possibility of actually managing this, or if we couldn't do it within the state service. So how do you get to a July 21 where you say 5 months from now, as part of our contract, they would then take over or assume full responsibility of API without a competitive process? I'm curious how you get there.
Through the chair, Senator Begich. When we reached out, and it was on one of the slides as well, part of the is we had this immediate crisis and we needed help on the ground. We did reach out and we did find out that WellPath was the only one that could get boots on the ground. And as we looked at this process, we have set up these key deliverables, as we've mentioned. And if you look at those deliverables, and relevant to the hour-long presentation we just gave, showing you the many deficiencies and years of effort that have failed at API, if they can meet those key deliverables in a four-month time frame, whereas the state has failed over the last two decades, then this is the company that we want managing this group.
If I may, just to add, it may be the company that you may want, but that is not what the law says. And I think this is really important for you to understand as our commissioner and deputy commissioner, that the law is quite clear. If they, in fact, bring API to a place where API is no longer in an emergency situation, there is a procurement code that is statutory and regulatory that binds you. So, again, will you be opening this up to a competitive bid, or at least to the work required by statute for background review, for findings of fact that are considerable? If you look at the statute, you'll note that there is a considerable burden placed upon the department when it comes to these kinds of actions. So while you may like their performance, unless you craft a contract that is specific to that performance, there is a state requirement that this go to competitive bid. I applaud you for going and addressing the emergency situation, though I question a company that may have only existed since October. But at the same time, I am questioning whether or not we are abiding by the law of the state here.
And go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Begich through the chair. This is Al. So I greatly appreciate your question. We have a great deal of respect for the law, obviously, and for, in particular, the procurement statutes. There are more than just that statute that we're discussing here, and I would really like to get you a written legal explanation of what the choice was when we made it, if that's okay.
Yes, please come back to the committee and follow up, Senator Begich.
Yes, I understand the choice that was made, and I've heard that. I'm looking forward to that. I'm talking about an action on July 1st. 2019, that under the procurement code needs to be a competitive process with findings of fact. That's what I'm putting on the record here.
And just as a follow-up question to that, you know, we still have to wait to hear the final letter of decision from CMS, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And so we are still technically not out of the woods, out of our current emergency situation, until we know what that letter entails and dates of their findings, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I do have a question on staffing requirements, and obviously this has been, as you went through the presentation, it was a note. We had our wonderful privatization study that was done by the PC group in February of 17, and the committee had this sort of overview, and it talked about API recommendation was 18.1 nurses on the floor at all times. and they recommended about 21.2 nurses under their staffing recommendations in their scenario. At this time, is WellPath providing the current recommended nursing staffing requirements now, or are we still in a deficit of nurses to run our facility?
Mr. Chair, we are still in a deficit of nurses to run the facility. Their immediate focus is to bring us into compliance with CMS and to ensure the safety of the patients and to prepare for the future, at which time they will address the staffing issue. We are still recruiting, and they will be recruiting as we move forward. The instant workforce for actually putting in the nurses on the ward is going to be something that we grow over the next couple of months.
Okay, and I guess my clarifying question to that would be, then we're not looking at like a local tenants type of situation for some of the doctors, or looking at some agency nurses to fill in that need to just turn a, but right now you guys are just doing the overtime with the current nurses there. I'm just concerned upon the staffing levels of the nurses.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm deeply concerned about the staffing levels. And as a matter of fact, we've had locum agreements out for some time looking for locums for very specific positions that we don't have any applicants at all for, like a forensic psychologist, like a psychiatrist. We've had positions there for psychiatrists that have been vacant for years, just unable to recruit. No applicants, no locums, no nothing. We tend to fill those when we can with the mid-level practitioners, an advanced nurse practitioner with psychiatric specialty. But again, they don't fit that exact PCN in our classification structure. So I am concerned about that. We are trying everything that we can, including locums, to get new staff on the ground.
Okay. And then lastly, you know, in the last part of, I think, the option 4E of the prioritization study talks about some of the benefits and drawbacks to the comprehensive outsourcing. And just to know if the department can, you know, you don't have to answer this now, but if you can provide the committee sort of an option of the concerns of a reduction in staffing levels normally due through privatization, trying to find to save costs. And I know that we had a lot of emails and concerns about some of the safety. Again, a lot of it regards to the staffing levels of the nurses, and just trying to see if, make sure that we're providing the safety for the staff and patients, but also, as you mentioned, you know, API is a huge part of our behavioral health continuum within the state of Alaska, and just making sure that privatization will still have those key partnerships with our local community hospitals and our local providers as well. So I don't know if you can provide a statement to the committee at a later in time or to answer.
Mr. Chair, we'll certainly provide a statement on those issues. I would also like to point out that we are going to be updating the feasibility study to the level that we can in the time that we have.
Thank you. And I do appreciate all the transparency on having those different communications available on the website. I'm glad that the governor's keeping to his word on a transparent government. Is the copy of the current contract on the website too?
It is.
Okay, thank you. That's wonderful. Any closing comments, Commissioner Crum or Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity, and Senator, through the Chair, Senator Begich, thank you as well. I appreciate your questions and concerns on this. As we move through this process, this is something that we have to correct. API is such a focal point for the rest of the entire system that I've sat through meetings with the Alaska Native Health Board, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Board, and it unsolicited, these trustees and these board members bring up, we have to fix API and we have to address it as soon as possible, so then we can actually move our focus to the rest of the system of care, because it is such a it's been such a vacuum of attention that API is absorbing all of this, and it's a bottleneck for the rest of the system as well. It places an undue burden on the emergency departments, on our local partners, which is why when we did this announcement, we had a number of key partners actually stood up behind us and supported us with this. As we move forward on this, this is something that is going to give us the opportunity to fully address the entire continuum of care for behavioral health. And as I approached this role, and those are the very first conversation I actually had when I interviewed Deputy Commissioner Wall, was the issues on API and where behavioral health means for the rest of the state. So I'm did not want it to have to come at this rapid pace, but it was this immediate jeopardy needs and these items that popped up right away that truly, as I sat back and I looked at what was happening, I had to step in.
Well, thank you. That concludes our business for today. And again, thank you, Commissioner, for coming up on a short notice to present to the committee on the current ongoing issues at API. Are there any committee members' closing comments? Seeing none. On Friday, February 15th, we'll hear and take public testimony on Senate Bill 7, Work Requirements for Medicaid, by Senator Michicki. Thank you all for attending. And again, we'll hear from the department a little bit more comprehensive overview on their priorities and budget, I think, on February 27th. Thank you all for attending, and we are adjourned at 2:49 p.m.